Welcome to the 12th annual Danilo Husar-Struk Memorial Lecture. I am, needless to say, very grateful to all of you for coming. And I should make a long list of all the obstacles you've overcome to get here, of all the events that you've declined to participate in so that you can participate in this event. For all of those reasons and many others, I am grateful for your participation. And I believe you will not regret it. I believe that this year's talk, like many of the talks in previous years, will excite and encourage you to think about problems in Ukrainian literature. The Danilo Husar-Struk Memorial Lecture was founded precisely for that purpose. That is, it is a public lecture in English on themes from Ukrainian literature in order to widen the interest, in order to generate more interest in a subject that the late Danilo Husar-Struk held very near and dear to his heart. In this audience, I needn't spend a great deal of time telling you who Danilo Struk was. We, to this very day, sorely miss his presence in our department, and this lecture series is just a small way of institutionalizing our remembrance of him. This year's speaker is a particularly appropriate speaker for this series. Our speaker today, Dr. Marco Robert Stech, he's the kind of person that if all of the PhD students from our department went on to have careers like him, we would probably have thousands of applicants for our PhD program. He has certainly done a very great many things before and after his studies in our program. Dr. Stech was a PhD student with Danilo Struk and received his PhD from this department under Professor Struk's tutelage. Since then, he has had a career as a film producer, as a cultural businessman in Ukraine, as a professor of literature at York University, as a writer, that is not just a scholar writer, but an actual fiction writer. He is one of those rare examples of a Ukrainian living in the diaspora who actually writes fiction, a remarkable event in our community. And he is, of course, a very well-known literary scholar. He is a frequent contributor to a great many different scholarly venues. You can find his work very often in Ukrainian literary journals, particularly such journals as Kurier Kryvbasu, which frequently features his work, the Prague journal Ukrainsky Journal, another place where Dr. Stech is a frequent contributor. And most recently, he has become a television star, soon to replace Oprah in the ratings, with his segment on Eye on Culture, which appears on Saturdays on the Kontakt Ukrainian television program. And if you did not hear today's segment, shame on you, but it wasn't about Nikola Kulish, so that's okay. That is, it wasn't something that overlaps with today's lecture. I will not regale you with more of Mr. Stech's accomplishments. I invite him to take the floor, and please welcome Dr. Stech.
Дякую, Максиме. Dobrý večer, paní i panové. I welcome first of all the members of the family of Danilo Husar-Struk. I greatly appreciate the fact that you are here today, but as warmly I welcome everybody else. I am particularly grateful that you have decided to come here today to listen to my talk despite the very strong competition and tempting competition from other events in the Ukrainian community, and of course the weather. And I want to maybe start with a rather informal introduction, which I believe appropriately for the occasion will help me, will allow me to share a few memories, reminiscences of Danilo with you. And at the same time, and perhaps even more importantly, this kind of background will probably help you understand better the actual topic of my talk. It will help maybe bring certain points to the fore and let you make it easier for you to understand what I will speak about later. There are a number of reasons why I found it particularly appropriate to speak about Mykola Kulisz at a lecture dedicated to the memory of Danilo Husar-Struk. And the most obvious is that this was the topic of my PhD dissertation. Although I finished my PhD in 1992, and since that time my ideas about Mykola Kulisz and specifically about the plays that I will be talking about today evolved considerably, still fundamentally my understanding of his works remained roughly the same as we discussed it with Danilo in the late 80s and early 90s. And in that sense, Danilo's spirit will be here in a way. Less obviously, I can tell you that Danilo had a decisive, albeit not direct, influence on my choice of Mykola Kulisz as a topic of my dissertation. And I will briefly tell you the story. To make a long story short, it is in way back in 1986, when I started my master's with Danilo, I was very heavily involved in a amateur theater called Avant-Garde Ukrainian Theater. And as a founder and artistic director of the theater, I was constantly on the lookout for new plays. And I didn't know much about Ukrainian dramaturgy at that time. And it so happened that by pure accident, in searching the shelves of the Roberts Library here, I chanced upon a book that blew me away. It was a collection of plays by a playwright whose name didn't tell me anything at the time. His name was Ihor Kostecki, and it was a book entitled Teatr Perad Twoim Porogom. I immediately went to Danilo and I asked him, who is that man? And I've never read anything like that in Ukraine literature. Danilo didn't read him either. He knew about him. He said, yes, this guy is somewhere in Germany. He's a sort of a scandalous fellow, and he's somewhere in Germany. And however, although he was not entirely, he didn't know exactly what to tell me about Kostecki, he was actually very supportive in my idea when I almost on the spot said, okay, I want to do my master's on this guy. I want to go to Germany, I want to find whatever I can find about him and do that. And so I did, and again, to make it the long story short, I was late by 3 years. Kostecki died in 1983, this was 1986. But I managed to find his sister-in-law, who was still alive, who directed me towards an institute where I actually found his entire archives that were closed at the time. But still, because the friend of Kostecki was the head of the archive, they let me in to have a peek. And that was enough for me to write my dissertation. And then I, of course, when the dissertation was done, I came to Danilo and I said, Danilo, I want to do my PhD on the same guy. I really want to expand it. And at that time, Danilo, who by that time was basically allowing me to do whatever I wanted, said no, absolutely no. I said, why? And he said, Danilo, for all of you who know him, Danilo had normally liked to speak rather bluntly if he felt strongly about something. And he said, well, nobody knows anything about this guy. Nobody read him. Nobody will be able to tell, to really judge your work, whether you have your conclusions are okay or not. For my dissertation, you have to take a classic. You have to take somebody who is very well known, who has been studied, and who has been, and who is a classic already. And I probably don't have to tell you that I was not exactly happy with that. But from the perspective of time, but actually, this sort of justification that Danilo gave me did speak to me, and I, especially from the perspective of time, I'm very happy that it did. Because it forced me to really get very deeply into a crucial time in the Ukrainian cultural history, which is the 1920s. And I still believe that although this is such a well-known period and so many people study it, I still think that the majority of Ukrainians do not realize how crucial and how crucial a turning point in Ukrainian history that was. Most probably I would know it theoretically, but I would not have a very strong opinion, personal opinion about what was so crucial about it and how and in what way it was crucial. So I started. I was wavering a little bit between Lesya Ukrainka and Kulish, and I picked Kulish eventually, and. Once I started to read both Kulish and the criticism on Kulish, I understood that Danilo was very right, that it is really very important for a young scholar, well, a budding scholar, who wants to enter into a discourse, into a scholarly discourse, into a scholarly discussion with other scholars, to actually immediately react to other voices and to find one's own voice in relation to what has already been said, and actually taking a classic work and trying to find your own take and your own interpretation of it is an extremely important way of developing your own methodology, but also it is a very important opportunity to actually immediately jump into the discussion. The scholarly discussion about literature, and with people with whom who may be your great authorities for you, and continuing my sort of informal commentary, I very quickly understood that whatever was written about Kulish by that time, the late 80s. Was completely not satisfactory to me. I just did not buy it. Not only that, some of that I did buy. For example, it was difficult not to be impressed with some work by Yuri Shevelov, who wrote it. But still, what Shevelov wrote, seemed to me a very narrow approach to this very, very complex work. Of arguably, perhaps the best playwright we ever had in the Ukrainian literature. Well, in any case, one of the two, three very best ones. If you, just to give you a very brief idea, most scholars by that time considered Kulish from two potential vantage points. One was the social. And especially the Soviet scholars used the class struggle and the social issues as the main core of what Kulish had in his writing, and they're certainly there. There is no question about it. And there was the emigre writers who were focusing on the national, especially, I don't exactly know, but even today, who was the first who came up with, the idea of national trilogy, which consists of Narodni Malachi, Mina Mazailo is Patetichna Sonata in Kolisha's work. It was most probably Lavrinenko, but it could have been Šerek. But to me, this is an absolutely artificially created construct which has nothing to do with understanding Kulisha's continuity of his work. These three plays have very little to do with each other. Well, especially Mina Mazailo, that just doesn't fit to the other two, with the exception of the superficial theme, national theme. And but that was unfortunately enough for many, many emigre scholars to. And again, if I bring Danilo back here for a moment, and I when I came back to him first, and I told him what I want to do with my thesis, that what I want to argue. He listened to me carefully. He was not exactly immediately in agreement with me, and he basically, again, he had a way of summing up things that both in his teaching and in his scholarly writings, he always tried to get something concrete in one sentence, almost some sort of summation of an idea of something that would explain. Something that would actually explain. This was very useful for the students. Not always for the scholarly work, because it sort of sometimes tended to blur the nuances, just drive a wedge into some one particular point. But it was a very useful tool for students. We normally ended up getting a clear idea what Danilo thinks about a given work, and in a sort of intelligent, perceptive way. And so what he told me, I will just tell you verbatim as far as I remember it. He said, so, normally critics say that Kulisha is either about social issues or about national issues, and you are telling me that Kulisha is all about religion. And to some extent it is. This is what I was trying to tell him, with one exception. This of course, it's not religion in a strict sense of the word. I strongly believe that Kulisha was not a believer, that he was not a believer in, not only in any religious creed, but also in such things as the revolution, as socialism, as communism, that he, in general, was a man of particularly sober and pessimistic and skeptical mind. So there is no way that I would try to suggest that by using that in his place, Kulisha would have expressed his religious ideas. I don't believe that he had such. However, one cannot escape the fact, if one reads beyond the surface of his works, that it is all about religious symbols. That all of it, including his most Soviet-seemingly plays, the plays that even such perceptive critic as Yuri Šerek considered to be the naive period of the naive belief, Kulisha's naive belief in socialism, in communism, in the future of communism, I immediately found it to be not so. That at the very beginning, Kulisha was never naive about communism or about the prospects of the revolution. That from the almost very very outset, he was describing a tragedy of a failed hope, of failed hopes, of tragedy of people who cannot, by nature of life itself, cannot find their own individual dream within the social life of any sorts, but specifically within the Soviet context. And I started with the two earliest plays, the so-called propaganda plays. One is called 97 and one is called The Commune in the Steppes. Just very, very briefly, for those of you who may by any some chance not know much about Kulish. He came back. He came from a very, very modest, extremely humble origins in the southernmost part of Ukraine, in the steppes on the south of Kherson, from a landless, poor peasant. He didn't even have money to get education. He got education because his talents were recognized and people actually chipped in and paid for his school. And in that way, he was very active during the revolutionary times. I will not get into it, maybe during the question and answer period. But then in the early 1920s, he ended up in Odessa working for the Ministry of Education. And in 1924, in Odessa, he sent his first play to Kharkiv, to Gnat Jura and the Franco Theater, who immediately staged the play. But by the way, before staging it, ripping it apart and changing the ending, and sending Kulish in fury because of that, because it was not socially optimistic. It was not optimistic at all. It was actually counter-revolutionary in many ways. However, they changed it, and they after staging it, it became a tremendous hit. He became from a completely unknown clerk in Odessa, he became the most best-known contemporary Ukrainian dramatist. This play was played by almost any theater in Ukraine. It didn't help him very much. He had to wait 2 years before he could move to Kharkiv. In the meantime, he was sent to an exile, as he called it, to Zinovievsk, which is today's, which used to be called Yelisavetgrad. Today it's Kirovohrad, which was the complete backwater of Ukraine at that time. And it is there that he wrote the basically both of the plays that I will be discussing today. But then he moved to Kharkiv. He met two extremely important people in his life. Les Kurbas, who became his partner in the Brazil Theater and who was the first director of most of his future plays and who had a tremendous influence on, and Mykola Kvilevy, who had a tremendous influence on the not only political, but sort of the world view of Kulish, but and also on his political activity. Of course, Kulish was the replacement for Kvilevy as the head of Vaplite, of the famous Vaplite organization. But in any case, the first two plays are always considered to be propaganda plays. Which basically they are set in the south of Ukraine during the post-revolution in early 1920s, during the time of the first famine, and they set seemingly there is a struggle between the poor peasants and the rich peasants, and of course the poor peasants want to establish the new order, the new rule, and the richer peasants want to keep. They're old, first of all, keep their influence and wealth, and secondly, keep the old order as much as it is possible. And this has been done by everybody, including all of the Western emigre critics. When I read it, it didn't work for me at all, this interpretation. First and foremost, I found that there's peace in the village initially. There is no conflict between the two groups. The conflicts actually start only when there is a order coming from the local Soviet to expropriate church gold and give it to the war effort, and actually to seemingly to feed the poor, the hungry. It went to the many war efforts and to the armament in the Soviet Union as in the actual life. And it is only then that there is a polarization in the community. And the polarization is not along the economic lines. There are many poor peasants who actually stick with the church. And there are actually some communists, local communists, who actually switched sides and joined the other group. And to make a very long story short, if you want to read about it, there is an essay in this particular festschrift dedicated to Danilo about this particular place. But what I'm trying to prove is that, first and foremost, Kulish models his play on the Bible, on the biblical stories, and he uses very clearly biblical motifs, and he compares the struggle to Christ, but sort of a parodied Christ. And for two reasons, again, extremely, if I will simplify it to the utmost, for two reasons, and the first reason is that he presents psychology of people who are used by the conditioning, by the decades of conditioning, to associate any power with religion. The Russian Imperial Church was, of course, a part of the Russian government. It was an official institution that was to a large control, extent controlled by the Tsar, and it represented the Tsar. It represented the sort of, it compared the God's hierarchy to the hierarchy of its empire, and people who were taught to think in such categories automatically accepted the new power that came in also as a religious one. And when the church confrontation came in, it was a direct confrontation between the two divine powers. They knew very little about either of them. They were both mythological for them. And in that sense, also very, very deeply, deep psychologist that Kulish was, he is even going much deeper and explaining how it is, reflecting how it is through these numinous religious motifs that human strivings born by the revolution are actually, they are projected on and they are attempting to be attained. That actually, in fact, the revolution for these simple people, but also for more complex revolutionaries, is a religious quest. It's simply for psychological reasons, even if they absolutely did not consciously believe in any creed. Now, this was the sort of a background to maybe help you explain, help you understand why I would consider the next two plays that he wrote, which were comedies, which were seemingly very light comedies, not to be either light or comedies, but to be very, very densely filled with religious symbolism as well. And I will tell you, these two plays are called Otak Zahenu Huska, and the other one is called Huli Hurina. Both written, one written 1925, the other one 1926. And I will just briefly tell you what they are about, so that you can imagine and then you can follow the plot. At first glance, the main focus of the play Otak Zahenu Huska is to ridicule the Philistines, the provincial Philistines, the Mishtanstvo. And this is actually what he was writing in his own letters about this. And the play's main protagonist, Savati Savatovich, Savlovich Huska, is a stereotypical bourgeois. And he is frightened. He's actually a caricature. He's a caricature taken from Gogol's stories, this petty Tsarist clerk. And he is absolutely frightened to death by the revolution. And it's a very important understanding that he is completely taken aback, thrown off his balance, any sort of spiritual equilibrium. He only asks for some sort of drugs that would make the revolution end. He cannot stand the new order. And At one point, the new government places a Soviet official, in his house, just as a living quarters. He assigns the living quarters of one Soviet official in his house, and this is the official of the Hram CK, which is the Commission for the Liquidation of Illiteracy. But of course, the frightened Huska interprets it as Grand Cheka, the superior Cheka, superior secret police, and he is sure that this is his end. When he can take it no longer, and what happens? This person is absolutely doing nothing. He sits in his room and reads books, and this unnerves Huska to that degree that he decides to listen to the advice of his guest, a student from Kiev, Pierre Kirpatenko, who tells him to escape to a desert island. And he even finds an island in the Dnipro, sort of Plavni, where they can escape. And of course, it comes to, after all sorts of things, it becomes a great failure at escape. However, the fact that this play, which has many vaudeville scenes in it, is not a simple comedy like that, is indicated by Kulish's own musings about it. And in one of his letters, he writes to Ivan Dniprovsky that, and I will quote it, "I cannot make up my mind about the ending. Perhaps I should do this. Let the audience laugh for 2.5 acts and then bulge their eyes in horror when it sees that Huska really hanged himself on a willow in the marsh." Imagine, you have a light comedy about sort of mischanstvo and all sorts of there. There is 7 daughters who try, all of them try to get this student to marry them and so on. And then suddenly you have a death at the end. This person, out of fear, hangs himself. Again, I will remind you of Gogol, Mykola Gogol, and about his play, the Inspector General, Revisor, and the play that was particularly important for Kulish and for both of these plays. At the end of Revisor, there is a scene in which suddenly, in a very modern way, very unusual for 19th century, suddenly the main protagonist turns to the audience and starts to speak to the audience and say, "What are you laughing at? You're laughing at yourselves." And it's a moment of great horror at that time. And to some extent, I believe that this is what Kulish was musing about. Tell people, listen, you're laughing at yourselves. Because he was trying to show something much deeper than what seems to be on the surface. Now, it will become more clear when I tell you about the second play, what he was trying to do. Because even more pronounced, what actually struck me immediately when I started to read these plays, the first two plays have almost no literaturshchina, no intertextual motifs, with the exception of the Bible. Bible is quoted all over the place in these communist, seemingly agit plays. But here, it's all about intertextuality. And of course, there had to be a reason, and I was trying to look for that reason. And it is a basic copy of the plot of the Inspector General. There is 2 con men from Odessa stop in a provincial town, and they have no money, and they are really at their sort of wit's end. But by mistake, an innkeeper mistakes them, one of them, for a very famous Soviet journalist from the Moscow's Pravda. And before you know it, the whole town is considering that there is a journalist here and a member of the Central Committee of the Georgian Communist Party, and that everybody has to be on their toes. And of course, just like in but he is of course not happy only with that, because it takes only this part takes only a very small part of the first act. Very soon, these two con men take all the money that the community gathered for the plane, and they promise to take it to Moscow and deliver it themselves. Of course, it goes to their pocket immediately. But before they leave, one of them, as a joke, says, "Listen, I hear that in your town, Julio Juranito is buried." And of course, nobody knows who Julio Juranito is. And just to tell you, he's a fictional hero. He's a fictional literary figure from a 1922 novel by Ilya Ehrenburg called The Adventures of Julio Juranito and His Disciples. It's a very devilish, nihilistic character, but very funny at the same time. But I will tell about him more. But of course, nobody knows who that is. The mock journalist says, "You don't know? He's a teacher. He's a hero." He says he's Ehrenburg's hero. Of course, meaning the literary hero. But he leaves. Before he leaves, he still says, "Oh, it doesn't look good for you, you know, that you even don't know your own heroes." And he leaves, and the whole town is trying to find the grave of the hero, teacher. They try to ask the old people who would remember anybody, and so nobody, of course, remembers anything. First and foremost, they forget the name. Ukrainian, whatever they could remember was Huli Hurina. Of course, they had to make it more Ukrainian. There is a split in the town because of the various gossip. Part of the town considers him to be a saint, and the other part a Soviet sort of revolutionary. And both of them try to find the grave first. And finally, they find a cross. And on the cross says only "who," suggesting various things. But that's enough for them to say, "Find, we found him." And they organize a huge celebration, and they want to rename the street, and they want to name the school after that as well. And only it stops when the news come about the arrest of the two con men. And suddenly they realize with horror that it was all a... It was that they were all fooled, that they were all fools. Now, Ukrainian theater critics immediately assumed that these are just simply critiques of Ukrainian backwardness and the social. And at the same time, Huli Hurina was the first in the Soviet Union, play in the Soviet Union that actually criticized in such a way the Soviet authorities. Nobody else dared before Kulish to do that. However, as I say, it did not sound right to me, especially when I started to pick apart all of the intertextual motifs, all of the books that he tries to read, because he not only uses Gogol, he also uses, of course, Ehrenburg and Julio Juranito and a number of other works from that period of time, starting with the Russian Silver Age and so on. And of course, there was one motif that was common among them that I found, and that was the devil. And I started to dig. And of course, soon enough, I found the book that is largely forgotten today, but which was extremely, extremely important and influential at that time. It was a book by Dmitry Merezhkovsky, published in 1906, which was called Gogol and the Devil. And aptly, I named my talk today in a similar fashion. Merezhkovsky, by the way, a Ukrainian by lineage. His great-grandfather, Fedor Merezhko, was one of the middle strata of Cossack hetmanate administration in Luhiv. his son Ivan moved to St. Petersburg, changed his name, and the family kept their Ukrainian sentiment throughout, although it was fully Russified. And to tell you the truth, the fact that it was Mereshkovsky who is discovering the devil, the great importance of the devil in the works of Gogol, I will not have the time to talk to you about it, but you can ask me after in the question and answer period. Ukrainians have a particular predilection to treat the topic of the demonic in a very unique way. In a way that is actually I have not seen in any other literature. But let's return to Mereshkovsky. Mereshkovsky treated Gogol as a mystic, and he based his main thesis of the book about him and the devil on a letter that Gogol wrote to, well, not many letters that Gogol wrote about the main focus of his work. And one particular quote that I would like to quote here is, "My sole concern has long been that after my work people should have a good hearty laugh at the devil." It was, Gogol considered laughter to be a weapon against the devil. It would take a long time to explain it, so I will not start. However, Mereshkovsky, of Ukrainian origin, with a particularly Ukrainian frame of mind, which again I will not be able to explain right now, understands that the understanding of the devil by Gogol is completely different than what the devil is understood by other cultures. And I will quote a few. "Devil is a mystical essence and a real being in which eternal evil, a denial of God, has been concentrated. And for that reason, the devil is the denial of the infinite. Devil is something that is begun and is left unfinished, but purports to be without beginning and end. Devil is the denial of all heights and depths, eternal planarity, eternal banality." And the word in Russian is poshlost, which is untranslatable into English, but it's sort of the most banal and at the same time commonplace, uninspired thing. And for Mereshkovsky, the sole subject of Gogol's art is the devil in just this sense. That is, the devil is the manifestation of man's immortal banality, poshlost. Banality sub specie eternitatis. Gogol was the first to detect invisible evil, most terrible and enduring, not in tragedy, but in the absence of everything tragic. Not in power, but in impotence. Not in acuity and profundity, but in inanity and planarity, in the banality of all human feelings and thoughts. Not in the greatest things, but in the smallest. From this perspective, the devil's main task and talent is to appear to what he is not, to be what he is not, that is to pretend to be great and powerful when he is weak and nothing like anything. Gogol, according to Mereshkovsky, was the first to glimpse the devil without a mask, first to glimpse his real self that is terrible not because it is extraordinary, but because it is ordinary and banal. He was the first to realize that the self of the devil is not remote, alien, strange, fantastic, but is rather very common, familiar, real, and human, all too human. The self of the crowd, the self such as everyone has, almost our own self, at those times when we dare not to be our real selves and consent to be like everyone else. That's the point, when a person renounces his own true self and conforms to the rest. That's, for Gogol and for Mereshkovsky, that's evil. That's the source of evil. Not any power, but that ability to and readiness to give in to the temptation, to give in to weakness. For Mereshkovsky, the primary incarnations of the demonic principle were Gogol's characters Khlestakov from The Revisor and Chichikov from The Dead Souls. He wrote, "In The Inspector General and Dead Souls, the scenes of a provincial Russian town of the 1820s have, aside from the obvious meaning, a certain veiled, eternal, universal, prototypical one. In the slothfulness and emptiness, the banality of man's world, it is not man, but devil himself, the father of the lie, in the form of Khlestakov and Chichikov, who weaves his eternal, universal web of gossip." Web of gossip. He considers the most devilish things to be the most banal, the gossip, the desire to be comfortable at any cost, to be peaceful, peaceful in a way that would be, I will still come back to that, but this is, and if we look at today's world where gossip is front page news, we could actually think about this kind of trend in our society. Again, both Gogol and Mereshkovsky were deeply religious, and they actually believed in their duty to fight against devil. Kulish is not, and what he does in his plays has different meaning. However, what struck me was that the mechanism of psychological behavior of his characters is exactly the same as described by Mereshkovsky regarding to Gogol. And as I said, the Gogolian's devil chief weapon is the ability to deceive, deception, and a mimic. And we of course know that both Khlestakov and Sosnovsky here in Kulish mimicked somebody else to get what they wanted. And everything else was done by other people. They didn't have to do anything more. But there is even a more interesting character in Otak Zohino Huska. He's called Pierre Kirpatenko. And he explained to Huska how he should behave in a new way. And he explains how he himself behaves. And he says, "Assume a pose and stand thus, simulating and pretending that you too support a revolution, socialism, etc. For example, assumes pose. I declare, comrades, what did Karl Marx write? Karl Marx wrote that labor and capital are labor and capital, and I have supported this view since long ago." And then he adds, "The best helm in your life is our tongue. One can sail through any revolution with it. Join the Russian Communist Party, confiscate your own building and rent it out." Think about Ukraine today, how these things are done. Instead of Russian Communist Party, Party of the Regions. Anyway, but what is important here is that it's something deeper, that Kirpatensko's desire to adapt to the circumstances is not only conformist for his pure practical needs. Actually, there is nothing underneath. He has to conform to something. And Mereshkovsky explains this kind of situation. "Man tries to be something other than what he is because he does not wish to be, he cannot be, he should not be nothing." And Kirpatenko is precisely a case of inner emptiness and the absence of a definite self. And he shows it in a number of scenes. Unfortunately, I will not have the time because I would then have to go over the time. But also there is a very clear connection to the devil in the name. Again, maybe for us it doesn't say, the very strange name Kirpatenko doesn't really say much, but for anybody who lived in 1926 and where one of the most popular novels was a novel written in 1917 by Volodymyr Vinnichenko called Zapiski Kirpatego Mefistofela, where we have Kirpati, Mefistofel. And especially if you compare the characters of the two, Kirpatenko is the son of Kirpati, Mephistopheles. They follow the same kind of development. They have the same type of desire to demoralize. In fact, what Kirpatenko is trying to do with Huska, who is, although he's portrayed as an idiot, he's not an idiot at all. If you really read his text and follow his behavior, he's a man of very deep conviction and a very strong identity, as opposed to Kirpatenko. He simply cannot change. He cannot adapt to new times. He is absolutely overtaken by the things that he would have to do, which are against his nature. And what Kirpatenko is trying to do is to try to erode these ideals, to make him basically into the same empty person who would pretend to be somebody else. Again, this takes it a little bit further along the... I may explain many of these things in the question and answer period, but it is a long paper. It's, by the way, in this juice. If somebody would like to get a closer look at it. But there is another issue. The fact that Kirpatenko is able to convince Huska, who is extremely firm in his beliefs, who is extremely level-headed, an extremely practical man, it shows another thing that Mereshkovsky is pointing out about the devil's work in Gogol. And in Gogol you see it all over the place, that the devil in Gogol has an ability to confuse you, has ability to confuse your mind to such a degree that you don't know what you're doing. At the end of Inspector General, these characters are almost, they wake up from a dream. And I can read to you, if my life depended on it, I could not say how it happened. It's as though our minds were befogged, or the devil confounded us. That's direct quote from Gogol from that. If you look at both plays, it's of Kulish, it's exactly the same situation. And most clearly it is seen in Huli Hurena. Not only that the head of the Soviet sort of committee there, Homa Bozhi, by the way, Bozhi, what a name. It takes immediately the Baroque. I didn't mention many connections to the Baroque that would be in place here, because I can tell you later about them. But Homa Bozhi immediately resists the revisor scenario when the mock journalist comes to his office and everybody jumps up, and Homa says, "What's happening? What's the commotion? Is he a governor or the old regime that you have leaped 3 meters high?" However, once, and he almost gets in his sort of dignified way with this man up until the end, until Julio Jaranito comes in. Then he really loses it. And he becomes one of the most important seeker for the grave of Julio Jaranito. But what is even more interesting is that the journalist, the actual journalist, local journalist, who writes for local newspaper and writes the story about it, read the book, and he says that he read the book by Ehrenburg. He knew about this character. And for some reason, it's as if he lost his mind. And he even wrote a huge column on the hero. So this is not accidental. There are all of the dots are connected here by Kulish himself in his play. So I will come back for a moment to Revisor, and will remind you again about the last scene. With the last scene is petrified crowd expecting the new inspector general, and at the same time Khlestakov on a troika is riding off into the sunset, basically. And what Mereshkovsky says about him, the juxtaposition of these two. The Mereshkovsky, can it be that the petrified Russian polity, the burghers that were left behind, is all of Russia, past and present, and that Khlestakov, flying off to the devil's domain somewhere is the Russia to be. The actual banality of what is now and the phantasmal banality of what will be. These are the two equally lamentable ends that are being pursued by Russia. Two equally dreadful roads that lead to the devil, to emptiness, to nihilism, to nothingness. This was written in 1906. He was quite a perceptive man, already seeing the, on the one hand side, the Bolshevik movement, and on the other side, the conservative way that didn't want to change anything at all. A careful reading of Kulish's works shows that Kulish saw the situation in the Soviet Union already, in Soviet Ukraine, in exactly the same way. That he did not actually see future. And the old Ukraine society is presented there as these idiots, who just bumbling idiots. And on the other hand, the prophet of a new reality is Narodny Malachi, Malachi Stakhanchik, who sees this bright future of communism. But listen to what he says about the bright future of communism. In the azure mist glimmers some kind of new Jerusalem, and further on azure valleys, azure mountains, again valleys, azure rains, downpours, and finally an azure nothing. That's what he saw, the future of the of that revolutionary new reality. It is hardly surprising that Kulish uses religious symbolism and terminology and actually talks about the devil, because it is actually a very strange thing that most current literary scholars tend to think as if there was a break in 1917 or 1918 or 1919 and somehow people's minds were changed. Nobody at all disputes the symbolic, mystical nature of the Russian Silver Age, the symbolists. The same with the Ukrainian. But suddenly, after 1917-1918, everybody talks about social issues. Nobody talks about religion. But it is not. It is, of course, impossible. And if you read, I could quote you a number of scholars who actually think otherwise and quote a number of people, but I could just give you an example of a number of authors who actually wrote in a very similar vein that Kulish was writing, and again from Ukraine, the Russian author Mikhail Bulgakov, who in 1925, exactly the same time, writes the collection of short stories Diavoliada. And his main character is Chichikov. It's the spirit of the time that obviously expresses the same kind of interests. But the most important thing that I want to talk to you about is the book actually by Ehrenburg, the Julio Juranito. The demonic aspect of Julio Juranito is even absolutely obvious. It's made clear. And because in the first scene when Julio appears, he is seen with a pair of small horns steeply rising from the locks of above his temples, while the coat strove vainly to cover a pointed, pugnaciously appraised tail. Of course, it turns out to be an illusion, an illusion. And not only that, Julio Juranito, when he talks to the narrator, he says, he denies even the existence of the devil. He says, "I know who you think I am, but he does not exist." Nonetheless, shocked by the nihilism of Juranito's views, the narrator cries out, "You haven't got a tail, but you are he, all right." Now, Julio's anarchist features are also vividly brought out. Antichrist features. Because he gathers his apostles. Most of his speeches are actually twisted quotes from Christ, from the Gospels. And he is also depicted very often. And in the end, he has to die a sacrificial death. And because he doesn't believe in anything, absolutely, and he cannot die for an idea, he decides to die for boots. He puts on new boots and leaves for Ukraine, and he knows that they will kill him for the boots. That's the image of Ukrainians in that particular, and that's the place where he supposedly was buried then. And he dies in that way. However, what is very interesting is that Julio is not a really, he does not promote ideas. He takes ideas expressed by other people to their logical conclusions, and he shows them who they are. And I think that one of the best part of that is when he talks to the Bolsheviks. And he says the following when he is... All right, just I will find the proper... You are destroying freedom. That is why I salute you. For the present, freedom, in quotation marks, is a counter-revolutionary concept. If you don't shoot me, he talks it before being actually trying to be executed, I'll collaborate with you to the full. That is, I shall destroy beauty and freedom of thought, feeling and action, wherever I can, in the name of a unified, lawful, and correct organization of mankind. Your mission is a great and complicated one, to accustom men to their fetters until they come to regard them as a mother's tender caress. To achieve this, you must create a new mystique for a new slavery. A very interesting prediction made in 1922 that basically predicts 1930s. Exactly. And actually, Julio Juranito uses many quotes that were later attributed to Stalin. For example, in one place he says, between killing one weak-minded old man and 10 million people for the good of mankind, there is only an arithmetical difference. That quote is actually attributed to Stalin. But so in his insightful exposure of the essence of Bolshevik mission, he is actually predicting the future, and he actually draws pictures of massive killings of people that are necessary to get to the next stage. That at the same time, the cynical mystique of a new slavery, which actually at one point he calls proletarian culture, which of course was in the 1930s. Kulish, to a large extent, as is seen from a deeper analysis of his plays, has a very similar approach to this. And he sees it almost in as pessimistic a way as Julio Juranito describes it. There is one aspect of it, and I will not have time to explain to you in detail. Maybe if you want to hear it in the question and answer. At this time comes a distinction between two types of a devil. One which is the minor devil, Mephistopheles, the Khlestakov, the petty sort of trickster. And then there is a Diabolus Mayor. And I will quote to you I will give you two quotes. One from a poet and writer, Mieczysław Jastrun, who actually expressed it very, very deeply. And he said, the Satan of the 20th century would need to be the personification of the hell of the concentration camps, of the confutation of all worldviews and of the meaning of life. He would need to embody not only the negation of all values, but something much worse and more insidious, an inversion of the meanings of words, along with coercion to enforce public recognition of primary meanings. In other words, the Satan of the apocalypse and the Satan of complete duplicity is the Satan of complete duplicity bordering on the absurd. It means, I will give you an example of the 1930s, that when people are shot or starved in millions, at the same time, art is promoting the idea that we are moving closer to the heaven on earth, and our wisest leader is close to God, basically. There is a very close link between Julio Jurenito and Kulishas Kuli Jurena that was missed for some reason by anybody that I read who discussed this play ever. There's one small, although it doesn't seem to be any connection between the two, but there is actually a one scene. After the outbreak of World War I, Julio Jurenito explains to his disciples, it's a particularly important point in history, that they are now, that these people who are fighting are working for a master without a face, without a spirit, unborn yet infinitely cruel in the womb. And he is describing this as Diabolus Maior. Now, in the courtyard of a Parisian building, they find an abandoned statue, half destroyed, of a man who is who holds something like a book in his hand, and the other, and something like scale in the other hand. And Julio decides to make a little provocation, and he calls this a champion of civilization, holding a declaration of human and civil rights, and a scale, the symbol of eternal justice. And when the concierge says that this depicts a deceased storekeeper with his scale and ledger, it is completely ignored, and masses of people come flocking to pay tribute to that champion of humanity. Now, there is the same situation in Kuli Jurena and in Kulish. They come to a grave which has a half-rotten cross and the words "Who" on it. And what I learned in the course of my research, that in the 1920s, the satanic sects, which were quite proliferated, quite common in the former Soviet Union, used the image, mock image of crucifixion as a penis crucified. Christ presented as penis. By the way, the famous film director Sergei Eisenstein belonged to one of these. And actually, these are his drawings that I saw. So you see that in Kulish's play, people of the old type, of the old mindset, who think that he was a saint, march to the same grave as the new communists who think that he is a revolutionary hero, and they are worshipping Diabolus Maior in many ways. And such an interpretation of Kuli Jurena is further confirmed by other motifs of the invisible demonic power in Kulish's other plays, because this is actually confirmed by similar motifs in other plays. I will mention only one example here, and because I don't have the time. Who is Huska's mysterious guest, the man who is living in his, who does nothing and creates the whole havoc? Well, in the one sense, he is a prefiguration of Narodny Malachi, because if you may remember, those of you who read the play, Malachi locks himself for 2 years, reads Bolshevik books, mixes it all up with the Bible, and comes up with his theory. Here, and by the way, in his behavior, he is very demonic in many ways, something that Ukrainian emigre critics did not want to see, because he was sort of anti-Soviet, should be good. Now, the Evdia, who is the maid, insists that this tenant reads black books. But the strange... However, he is the member of the Grand Ramchaka, the liquidation of illiteracy, while Julio Jurenito, goes to Ukraine to die exactly as a member of Ramchaka. So there is a direct connection again between Kulish and Jurenito, if you are careful and if you read these things carefully. So I would give you a number of other examples if I had time, and you would see that Huska ends up to be a normal human being shocked by the revolutionary change around him, who ended up between the two devils, the small one, the Kirpatenko, and the larger one, which is already living in his home, and it represents something that is, well, represents the new power. A new power which does not necessarily have to be associated with Soviet power, but the new power that is running the show from now on. And it is actually similar to the circumstances of the protagonists of Revisor at the end of the play, when Plestakov leaves and they are left waiting for the new Inspector General. Because most interpretations of Gogol treat the Inspector General as God, as the time of punishment has come and you will now respond for your stupidity. Well, Merezhkovsky doesn't see it that way at all. And Merezhkovsky is a man who understands Gogol, in my mind, better than most. And what he says is, he points out the ambivalence of the figure of Revisor. He says, we do not see him. For us, he remains an even more elusive and ghostly figure than Chlestakov. But if we had caught a glimpse of him, then who knows? Perhaps the two officials from St. Petersburg, great and small, might have borne a strange resemblance to one another after all. Small and large. Diabolus minor, and Diabolus mayor. Just to complete, despite the very pessimistic view of his of reality that he expressed in his plays, just like Gogol did, Kulish is actually trying to take a human stand. And the difference between the two writers, this is the summation and my last commentary, is shown in this last scene that in Revisor, when Gogol is trying to scream to the audience, who are you laughing at? You're laughing at yourself. He's trying to awaken audience to the absurdity of their own behavior, of their own thoughts. What Kulish wanted to do with Huska, he would make him hang himself, and people would only stare at a tragedy. The difference between the two writers, in my view, is that Gogol is always, by nature, a didactic writer. He wants to influence, he wants to convince, he wants to actually preach. Kulish is a tragic playwright. He shows the tragedy, but at the same time, in his real life, he was one of the most dedicated and one of the strongest opposers of this devilish reality that was happening around him, and especially this mimicry, the mimicry of presenting something to be something else, the mimicry of presenting the Soviet power and Soviet reality as paradise on earth, when he saw it as a famine of millions of people. And his choice was to remain unbreakable. I could give you a few stories about his time in prison, and about that he was one of the few ones who did not really break down. And, well, he did break down, but he did not break down in a way that he would endanger anybody else but himself. I want to leave you with the idea that it is worthwhile today to think about Merezhkovsky's interpretation of the devil as banality, as gossip, as pretending, as the reality show that is not reality at all. Of course, in political life, it is the PR that can make a saint out of a criminal, to maybe treat these things that we normally treat lightly with a little bit more seriousness. This is one of the benefits of reading classics with maybe, and going maybe a little bit deeper under the surface, because they always tell you about today. Thank you very much.